And we open it again, don't worry. My name is Uli Hohmann. I'm here to talk about Azure architecture patterns and the way they're slowly making it over to your side of the data center and not just our side of the data center. This is going to be a talk that covers a number of dimensions. We'll talk about data centers, we'll talk about fabrics, and we'll talk about applications. As I said to Albert, I think, from KPN, we are an equal opportunity screw-up person, so we will talk about the general patterns, not about Windows, Linux, or any of the specifics. It's about architecture patterns and so forth. Since it's 3:15, we are going to make it a little bit livelier, and I'll tell you some stories about real things that we've seen happening so that you kind of stay awake with me, I hope. If not, I have the chief heckler in the back, Eduardo. Where are you? Ah, no promise, apparently. So he promised that he would keep the room entertained if I get started to be boring. So feel free to throw ideas in to help him heckle the session. So if you think about what's happening in data centers, and that's one of the design patterns that's slowly moving into your environment, not just from us, but also from other people, where the idea of raised floors, which I'm sure lots of people still do, and that's a perfectly fine pattern, all the way down to containers is effectively something that we're shipping today. So last week we announced CPS, the Cloud Platform System, which in partnership with Dell is a Azure-like compute model in a box. Our friends from VMware have been showing this for a while with VCE, and you will see more of that. The moral of the story here is that the times when people were wiring data centers together by hand or server racks are going to go away, which means if you are in that business, start to think about higher level services you can offer your company, because it really doesn't make sense for trained professionals at a company that's in banking or automotive or healthcare to start thinking about wiring and plying with wires. Because either we provide you with data centers, I'm sure, I didn't see Jason's keynote this morning, but I'm sure he had the little football field slide out there with 600,000 servers and stuff like that. So we are going to give you a heck of a lot of capability in order for you to use them. So start really thinking about how does these data center patterns change the way you think about providing compute, storage, and network as its basics. The other piece that we're looking at is how do you provide capability that effectively aligns with the switch from what's going on in an environment called the data center. The dirty trick or the dirty secret that most people haven't heard, Albert was in my IoT session, so he has heard this one, is that most of the cloud providers are actually network operators. Google, Microsoft are very, very large network operators, and the reason for that is that latency and access to compute capability make a difference. Some of you, I'm sure, have worldwide deployments, and you know how much fun it is if you have, let's say, a data center in Amsterdam, and you're connecting a workstation from New Zealand. Which is, I think, part of the worst connectivity that you can ever offer. And so part of what's happening is we are moving into a flat network in the data center, global network connectivity, and people like Titanfall, most of you will have heard that one at least in some of our keynotes, our executives love that example, where our Titanfall friends, which is an Xbox One game, where they give you an avatar effectively, a virtual machine per player, and a virtual machine running on Azure. The reason why they picked Azure, although they have data centers, is because they tested latency against in the US all over the place, and they found that the Microsoft data centers were much more, had less latency than what they could offer, and so it was effectively key to their game. There might be scenarios where latency doesn't matter, but gaming, for example, Internet of Things, and other pieces are really critical. And not just from a latency perspective, but also from a global distribution perspective. So we have clouds in Brazil, China, Japan, and so forth. So what is it now, 19 regions? And so think about the global distribution, and then of course our network partners, and then of course your own data centers. So you have a connection of data centers with respect to moving from a single isolated solution to a fabric of connected endpoints inside a data center and connected data centers across the globe. A couple of things that are interesting. Cookie cutter. When I go to my enterprise customers, I see all animals in the zoo, every single one of them. It doesn't really matter if you have been in business more than 10 years, you will have a mainframe most of the time. If you're in banking specifically, insurances have mainframes. Then you have the minis running around, and none of them have been turned off. Then you have various Unixes running around. Then you will have Windows in various forms and disguises. And everything is different. Because a lot of times, IT reacts. IT has to react because you're project-based. You effectively get told, do this, then you come up with a solution in time, which is the normal way of thinking about it. When you look at cloud paradigms, and I know most of you are either trying to get there or are already there, you're effectively saying we're going to engineer a service catalog of capabilities we believe we need. And then you're taking that service catalog to market with your business units. And that requires a certain change in head thinking and so forth. The way I generally describe it, cloud is a way of life. It's not just a technology or a business model. It's something you really have to get into your head and change your behaviors. It always starts with people. This technology stuff is actually really easy. The people is always hard because you told your business units how to behave. Guess what? That's what they do. So if you can't get to cookie cutter in your environment, you're not doing cloud, whatever self-service portal and other things you do about it. Those are nice trimmings, but the cookie cutter consistency, templated approach is really what makes up clouds. And again, a number of other dimensions as well, but certainly that is a key one. The other piece that we have done a lot of work on, and again, I've been spending a lot of times in places like the UK or England to be more precise, where we actually had a spreadsheet where every piece of equipment with a nominal power output would be entered, and we said, nope, sorry, you can't put that into the data center anymore because we're running out of power. And that is a very common situation in existing data centers. But part of what we are doing here is we're moving from space allocation, which is a concern if you're in a very expensive area, to power allocation. So any of the data centers that Google, Microsoft, Amazon, Facebook, any of these guys are putting into place is in a place where it's naturally cooling, so you don't need cooling for the stuff because the air is cold enough. So Iceland right now is a very nice place. Scandinavia is also very hot, meaning lots of data centers being built. And we are going into places where there's lots of land, and we're going to places where there is power generation nearby. Ideally, it's something that's renewable. So when you look at Quincy in Washington, if you have never been to visit us in Redmond, come over and book a tour to our data center in Quincy. It's in the middle of bloody nowhere. It really is behind, as the saying goes, behind the seven mountains with the seven dwarfs. You're just looking for Snow White, where is she? But you effectively can't find her. But it is wheat fields all over the place, cows, and then data centers. Why? Because there is a dam right next door that generates water power, and we're using that to power stuff, and there's lots of land. That's one of the areas where Jason's data centers, the 600,000 server ones, are currently being built up to handle this. And of course, we are now tracking other things that are going to become important. Power, carbon, utilization is already a known thing, but carbon, for example, is something that will become important again. In 2008, right before the financial crash, what was the number one topic that IT talked about? Green IT. Carbon, CO2, all that stuff was being very important. Then the financial crash came. All of a sudden, this green stuff was not important anymore. How do we come out of this hole was important. But we are getting back into this thing because even the American president has now, Obama was always okay on that one, where he said, no, actually this climate stuff is actually real. We can't avoid it. I read an interesting, if you're into wine and you like Rhone wine is in trouble. The Grenache doesn't like the temperature anymore. It's actually getting too hot for it in the Rhone region. So they need to move to England or something to go where it's a little bit cooler. The other piece, we talked already about standardization. Single architecture. Don't support little animals. There's only one of them. You can pick a monkey, you can pick a horse, you can pick a giraffe, doesn't matter, pick one. And fight the people that want to specialize. But be smart about it. Remember, humans. So when you start to do cloud, what most customers tell me is we're going to start with infrastructure as a service. And then we're going to offer SharePoint on, as a service, or CRM as a service, whatever it might be. So higher level services. Now look at yourself. What would you do if you had a VM and you had control over it? No IT person could screw with you. What do? You will never give it up. Never. You pry that VM out of people's dead hands. No way. Because people love control. And again, if you are in the IT business, what do you do to me? So you don't use PaaS services or SaaS services. You try to use infrastructure as a service because the business told you, use this cloud thing. It's cheaper. Cool. But then you're saying, but I'm going to control all the VMs, the VNets, and all this other stuff because that's what I do. And there's good reasons for that sometimes. But again, it's all about control. So when you standardize and when you limit configuration, figure out a way to offer those guys something in return so that they can control. Don't give them this black box that doesn't allow you anything in terms of changing. It's a very important part. Without standardization, you can't get into a cloud model. But with standardization come sacrifices on the side of the user. So you need to think about how you balance that little problem. Service change. So the one other thing that I see us talk a lot about in the industry is continuous innovation, continuous change. How do you do that in your environment? Normally, IT says, hey, this is going to be deployed. I'm going to use it. For the next 10 years, it's not going to change. XP, remember anybody? Windows Server 2003? That's effectively the effect, is because you saw no reason to change anything. It was fine. We are telling you now that you need to continuously change. Now the question is, if you're a project-based budgeting environment, how do you do that? Because you're done with your project and then the funding runs out, outside of the operational funding. So there's a bunch of interesting implications here that if you say, hey, I'm a cloud guy on-premise, you also mean you're continuously improving things. How do you do that when you have a project-based innovation culture, investment? Deployment, again, this is an example to Office 365, so we don't necessarily need to think about AD cleanup when we do things, but there's always something that you need to think about when you deploy stuff. And then privacy and security, even in your private cloud, you have to start thinking about privacy and security. Let me tell you a story. So there's a very well-known bank that is currently in the process of consolidation. And consolidation means they're going from 80 data centers, sometimes just a rack in some closet, to 3 worldwide. But they're operating multinational. So all of a sudden, these guys have to go through the same pain that a public cloud provider has to go through, because they're now having to support Hong Kong law, Singapore law, English law, German law, all that other stuff, because they're a bank, highly regulated, and it doesn't matter if you're running in a private cloud if you're running in a public cloud. It depends, of course, on your business, but thinking through privacy and security is something that is really complicated. I don't know if you have looked at Azure lately. The list of certifications that we support is almost as long as my foot or something like that. Very, very long. And it's a pain in the behind, I can tell you that. Because it is complex, and a lot of times, if you're in the banking business, you know what I'm talking about. The guys will actually tell you, not tell you what the regulations really mean. They will tell you, implement it, come back to me, and I'll tell you if you meet my requirements. I call that the fetch a rock scenario. Fetch a rock, you like it? Nope. So you go back, and they will still not tell you what they don't like about it, but you have to go back. So clouds are effectively about standardization. You're thinking about continuous innovation and changes. You're thinking about deploying in a continuous fashion, upgrading and so forth. And you have to start thinking about privacy and security in a different way, because you're centralizing, you're sharing environments. It's not a single solution on a single environment anymore and so forth. Again, the mileage you get in terms of this conversation will vary, but if you're a service provider, all of this applies to you. If you are a banking provider that has multiple countries hosted in a certain environment, all of this will apply to you, and so forth. So what have we learned after a long set of years and lots of pain, trust me, where a lot of people thought they knew, and then they deployed, and then, oops, it didn't work. So extreme standardization is what they call it here in this slide. Standardize, standardize, standardize. You've got to kill, in quotes, the variations. They will hurt you. And in order to really move forward, you've got to do it. Introduce SLAs. If you don't want to do SLAs internally, introduce SLOs, objectives. Tell them what it costs to do certain things. So I always hear this from the business, we need a five nines architecture. Five nines, okay? You guys know what that means, meaning downtime is almost zero. If you tell them you can have three nines for $10,000 and you get five nines for $500,000, for some reason, no business ever insists on these five nines. I'm using extreme numbers to make it very clear. But part of the SLA culture is actually, I'm telling you what I'm giving you, and I'm giving you a price for that. Internally or not, it doesn't really matter. And as soon as you be explicit, A, you give control back, the guys can choose, and in general, except if you're a public sector customer where pricing doesn't matter often, not always, it's certainly something to think about. The other piece we have done a lot of work in internally and are creating more and more in the community and also in Azure and Windows Server is really thinking through IT management processes, thinking through automation and change control. So Bing is the most extreme application that I know of. Currently it runs about 500,000 servers across the globe. When the tsunami in Japan hit, we had a couple of colos in Japan which were running Bing services. Within 10 seconds, the whole system, the whole load was revectored to Hong Kong and Singapore. No human being involved, it was just detecting an issue in the system and it reimagined the whole thing. And it told the operator, yes, I did that. Normally, when things change in a normal data center, red lights go off. Something moved. Don't move, system. Well, in the modern world, things move. They automate itself and they do stuff. And so your IT processes have to start thinking about how do I do that? And again, we are helping you with that kind of operational books, run books, and that kind of stuff. But you also have to start thinking, what is my single pane of glass look like? Is it okay if I moved and became elastic? So I moved from two servers to 50 and back to two over the span of 5 hours. Is that okay? Might be not. So those are some of the things that we believe are coming your way or are already in your way, and certainly something to think about as part of this. The other piece I always find fascinating. How many people have heard the term fabric from a Microsoft person? I'm sure lots of you. Has anybody defined ever what a fabric is? Everybody assumes they know, right? What are the characteristics of a fabric? I always find it fascinating. So when Mark Rusinovich talks about the fabric controller, what the hell is he talking about? I mean, he does it very eloquently. He looks like a rock star, so from that perspective, it's all good. But part of the question is, hey, what is it? So let's go through the history a bit. If you think about what I call mostly yesterday's platform, because I know that some of you are still in this business where you run physical, and when you deploy things, you purchase, install, deploy, et cetera, and everything is early bound. Changes are hard, very hard, because that's the model we decided. And good news is, it makes no difference which operating system you use. If it's Windows, Linux, hey, we are all equally guilty of binding things very early on into an operating system. The way I look at Windows marries its application, so we are very, very faithful. Once you install an app on Windows in general, it's really hard to get rid of, or expensive. You know, if you are in an X position like I am, you know what I'm talking about. So, et cetera, et cetera. With virtualization, we at least break the tight coupling of the hardware to the guest OS. And there's a bunch of other things, but the software stack is very much still statically bound. I didn't have time to update the presentation to include Docker, which are containers, which are starting to loosen up some of the bindings between the application and the guest OS, but that's a very recent innovation. So fabrics are certainly have these characteristics. So it's a base infrastructure that serves multiple workloads and roles. I know everybody says, well, that's very obvious. How many of you are really in a position to say that your critical applications run in this shared mode? Very, very few, because virtualization happens for non-critical applications in most cases, not everywhere. Some people are very brave, and I've talked to a bank in Australia that said, yes, we love this virtualization private cloud stuff, but can you get me a solution for the noisy neighbor? Because my trading application is really sensitive, and when all of a sudden the other side starts to pick up resources, that's a very bad idea. And if you look at the virtualization stack, we're pretty okay on networking cores, we're getting to storage cores, but we still don't have compute cores. That I can absolutely guarantee that this application gets 30% of the compute core. Because you all also apply overcommit from a VMware side, or what are we calling it, dynamic memory, dynamic something? I keep forgetting, because I talk mostly about my competitors, actually. And then infrastructure is managed as one resource. We're automating the whole thing. And then the other piece is it's provisioned to aggregate need rather than per project. Again, everybody says, yeah, that's very obvious. How many of you do that? Because it's really hard. Yeah, okay, good hand in the back there. I saw you. And then because of standardization and because of virtualization, hardware is becoming fungible. It used to be a real problem introducing multiple generations of hardware into a data center. With virtualization, that risk is becoming far less complicated because the software is isolated from the virtualization environment, from the hardware through virtualization, and that's a very, very good thing. But again, outside of Docker and some Java environments, .NET environments, we really are still very bound in the applications. So we're getting to a point where that becomes a fabric where you really will be able to deal with applications as one resource. And you can manage them across multiple servers and so forth. The best application, at least on the Windows stack right now, is the Windows Azure websites. They actually work as a fabric. And they automatically manage stuff back and forth. But nothing else really does on the Microsoft stack. Again, that's something that's coming, but right now we are really on the infrastructure fabric side, and these are the characteristics we are working against. So this is what Mark Rusinovich thinks about. When he talks about the fabric controller, he thinks about infrastructure management, provisioning against aggregate needs against the SLA he signed, and he effectively deploys VMs. Mark Rusinovich doesn't know anything about applications in his point of view from a fabric controller. He only knows VMs. That's effectively how he manages his life. Some advertising for our fine products. So we didn't put CPS on here, but that's one of the ways of implementing a fabric. You guys know that Windows Server does a bunch of great things, but there is still work to be done, and we are doing some work to improve the fabric capabilities. Now let's get to the fun part, at least for my part. Let's see how far, if you have fun. Now we talked about some of the data center, which is the core. Then we talked about the fabric as one of the design points that we work against. Always remember, when cloud computing got invented, even the AWS platform, it was about lots and lots of cheap things that looked the same. And anytime we do anything, we would deploy just more of it, because that's the cheap way of doing things. What is the enterprise design point? It is very few things, and they can be more expensive. They don't have to be, but they can be. The best example is the database. The relational database is the enterprise design point for most applications. How many internet services run a relational database at its core? Internet services. Zero. No Bing, no Google, no Facebook, none of these guys run a relational database at its core, because the relational database has problem with scale out. Having a relational database at scale out is easy, So we do this with sharding in the SQL database service. But you don't have the single database image that everybody's looking for. So transaction boundaries are not spanning multiple systems. You can't do backup restore and so forth. So when you think about cloud, you always have to think about lots of little things with independence. Now, this morning or last week, we announced the G-series VMs. And we announced provision I/O. Why are we doing that? Because it's clear that the enterprise applications that we would like to host and you would like to move don't support the cloud design point because they use a relational database and they're using the transactional scope of a single database image. So we had to introduce enterprise level hardware in order to make it work. And by the way, the G series is another nice little joke. When we initially named the G series, it was called the Godzilla SKU because it's fairly big. And now we are naming it the G series. I'm sure you see the connection between the two. So let's talk about some stuff. This is where I had a nice picture of Yoda. Unfortunately, the PR and copyrights people told me that you can't use that. I'd say, okay. So I said, okay, we attribute it to him. But the key thing that we want you, or I want you to take home, nothing else matters except this one. A lot of design decisions that you make in either infrastructure or solution design, you have to unlearn. It's okay to shard. It's okay to have lots of stuff flying around. It is not as neat as a single database image, but it has another set of advantages, which is unlimited scale. The cloud design point is not necessarily unlimited scale. It is actually what I call unknown scale or null scale, if you're a SQL guy. Null means I just don't know. And that's something that we don't really understand when we enterprise people. Because the enterprise people always know I have this many transactions, this many people, therefore I need this kind of architecture. Boom, and I put it out there. And in the cloud, you don't do that. Because otherwise, you actually lose your advantage of cloud computing, which is elasticity, dynamic allocation, all that other stuff. Try to do elasticity with SharePoint or another classic enterprise application. Good luck. The system will not like it. So, six things we have learned over the last 5 years that really help to think about stuff. Moving software into services. We'll talk about that. Services, not servers. We still have people thinking about servers, not services. Decomposition by workload, we'll talk about that. Modeled by the lifecycle, utilize scale units, and then design for operations. How many of you are in the operations business? Data center ops. You will love me, because these application people now actually have to live with their stuff. It's not just throw this over the wall and deal with it kind of thing. And we will have some funny anecdotes, at least from an ops perspective. The dev guys might not like it, but hey, tough luck. We talked about the scale-up stuff. And again, here I had the little 3D guy from up, but I can't use this picture. So I picked the Matterhorn, if you don't know this little mountain. 2003, I was all the way up there using the East grade. So that was pretty fun. So ideally, don't scale up, scale out. Don't use the smallest VM size, because VMs are capable of doing multiple things, but be something where you can add multiple things at the same time and keep growing. Don't build bottlenecks into your storage, into your queuing, or any of these other scenarios. Do not scale up. Scale up is possible. Remember the Godzilla SKU? But it's not desirable. If you can avoid it, don't do it. Again, easier said than done. If you need transactional capabilities or the database loveliness, which is awesome, and you have to have a single database image, go ahead. But think about it before you make the decision. As an enterprise developer, you will be drawn to that good old SQL database. It's our mother, it's our sister, it's our father, all that stuff. It effectively, if you really think about it, that's what we have built over the last 20, 25 years, since System R became viable. So it's not about upscale, it's really about scale out. Failure is the road to success. In this case, not failure in the sense of the project fails all the time. That's not going to work, guys, just as a guidance. But think about the notion, what we're trying to do in enterprise computing. What we're trying to do is avoid failure. You've heard the term mean time between failure, I assume, right? And that's what effectively is a measure that says how many, whatever the cycle is, can I run without the thing going to fail? And what we are trying to do over the last 20 years in engineering was trying to increase the number between failures, the time between failures. As it turns out, because clouds are so big and they are sharing everything, something is always going to fail. And if you design for the point that says nothing will fail and I will prevent failure, you will fail. The cloud fails all the time. Parts of it, not all of it. Sometimes we do that too. But in general, only parts of it. If you look at the 100% available systems, so the Japanese bullet train in Tokyo, how do they do that? They design a system with a bunch of modules, and they can take modules down without taking the whole system down. And that's the trick at the end of the day, to modularize the system and make systems independent of each other. And learn that failure is okay. You have to just deal with it. In general, the cloud deals with failure by having a copy at hand, saying, oh, I've got a failure, and here you go. So if the storage system, for example, fails, we have another copy as somewhere else, which we switch the traffic to. So it's clustering, but in a different way. So think about failure as a friend. You have heard about Chaos Monkey, I assume, the Netflix stuff. We have a similar project in GitHub or wherever it is located now, where we effectively throw failures into the system. Netflix, at least according to legend and myth, is doing that actually in production. I want to see the first bank putting a service out there and then knocking things out in production that could fail. That is certainly something that I think enterprises will be reluctant to do, but it is a very healthy thing to do. I also know BR, the Business Continuity Disaster Recovery. That's a very, very stylized exercise. We are going to do this weekend, and there's a lot of planning to happen. Well, just fail over, see what happens. Nobody does that yet, but again, it's something that ought to be done. Remember the Bing scenario? They just switched over the traffic and moved on. It's a relatively simple service because it's fairly stateless, or the state is cacheable. But again, something to think about. In order to avoid the problems here with failure, you need to start thinking about a third discipline. After security modeling, so threat modeling, and error handling and so forth, you need to start thinking about failure modeling. Failure modeling is a discipline like any other, and what you effectively are trying to do is determine where are the possible models of failure. So it's failure mode analysis. And failures can be mostly found in external dependencies. How many of you have deployed a service where you had a configuration file dependency? And when you opened the file, it wasn't there. Or the directory wasn't there because some developer or some operator did the wrong thing and you didn't check. Or you effectively have a corrupt file. So you didn't check the input and stuff like that. So lots and lots of stupid things we have seen, and everybody says, yeah, duh. But we don't do it. We don't do it really disciplined. Or database connections. I don't know if I have the slides in here. Nope, I don't. So database connections have, alone the database connection can have 30 failure points. Because you might not have access to the thing, it might not be addressable, it might not be this, that, and the other. And then you can determine what the action is you want to take. Do you want to stop the service, or if it's a configuration file, take a last known good approach? If you remember the NT4 days and the NT3.51, we had a last known good configuration. So whenever the thing rebooted, it put this configuration state away, and if it couldn't find the dynamic one, it fell back to the old one. So one of the Netflix solutions is when they can't find the Netflix server, because of the traffic manager or whatever they use is down, they actually have a copy of all the last known IP addresses of the video streaming services available locally. You don't want to use that, but you want to do it as a fallback. So always think about what is the possible failure scenario and how could I recover from it. Again, I've seen too many enterprise applications to believe anybody, yes, we do that. Maybe some of you do, but in general, we are way too trusting that the environment we have is the environment that's going to be there. Anatomy of a service. So we all love SOA, right? All of you do, I assume. Or some of you might have scars to say, oh my God, I believed all of it and it didn't quite work. SOA is going to stay with us as an architecture principle because composition, modularity, and so forth is very, very important. But what you need to think about is if you are building a Frankenholz, meaning out of multiple services, always understand what the dependencies you are taking. A, in failure mode, model what could go wrong. On the other side, understand what the SLA of the service is. And remember, no SLA does not mean that it's an awesome service. It just means no SLA. Just to give you a couple of examples. So we had a very successful project with a fictional character in a wizardy world, let's call it that. And those guys were effectively planning to use Facebook as their identity management system. And their expected traffic in the first 8 weeks was about 60 million people. And we kind of said, did you call Facebook? What do you mean, call Facebook? It's a service, right? Well, if you read the service correctly, there's actually a limit in terms of how many log-on attempts they will accept from a given IP address. And so when you are at the scale that those guys were thinking about, you might want to call these guys and saying, hey, whitelist this IP address. A lot of traffic is coming your way. Because otherwise, you might get thrown out in terms of driving the traffic. So they didn't even think about this. Another piece, there's a nice little service called Bitly that takes long URL addresses and makes it into cute little ones. No SLA. There was a political campaign service that one of our teams helped building, and they designed it and tested it, and they gave it over to a contractor. And the contractor thought that these URLs were really ugly. And so he put Bitly in. No offense to the Bitly guys, that wasn't their problem, but the guys never tested it. So at night, of course, when the election happened, guess what happened? The Bitly thing timed out, and the service got killed. So read the SLA, and read it carefully. Because when you look at the Azure or AWS SLAs, it tells you something about 99.96% availability. That's great. But then it tells you on the Azure storage thing, but you can only do 3,000 IOs per second. If you do more than that, I will shut you off. So if you need 5,000, you need 2 storage accounts. Stuff like that. So don't just say, oh yeah, it's 99.96. Read the fine print. Turn it around too. Create the fine print. Don't just say 99.96. If you have an internal service that you offer up for composition, put some fine print into your thing that says, I will only accept, 5,000 things per minute, per second, per whatever the right unit is, so that you can throttle. Because otherwise, people will kill you. Because not necessarily intentionally, some people will do that too, by the way. If you are opening it up and there is no throttle, people will put the gas pedal on. So I'm sure if you have an external endpoint, you know that there are lots of clever, unfriendly people out there. They will determine where your weaknesses are. And if you have no throttling in there, they will kill your service, no problem. So a lot of hard lessons learned in terms of how do you do that. So composition is great. Just make sure that you protect yourself and you understand what the services really are that the other person offers. REST-based APIs are the easy part, but the operational part is really the thing that you think about as part of it. And we have seen way too many people being very, very optimistic. Sure, this will all work. Always be very pessimistic, much, much better. Maybe not for your soul, but certainly for your solutions. And I'm a German, so I'm certainly pessimistic all the time, so that works. The other piece is scale units. Everybody aware of that term, having heard that before? So if you think about cloud computing, its beginning, a lot of this was about messaging and mail. So it's 1995, you have a thingy called Hotmail, which is a web-based mail service. You're a startup before Microsoft acquires you. How do you do capacity planning? So what we do when we have enterprise people, we look at, let's say it's a SharePoint environment or Exchange. I have 50,000 mailboxes with this kind of profile, and boom, I'm going to put this many Exchange servers, storage servers, and so forth out there. But what do you do in your Hotmail? What you're doing is you're turning the capacity on its head and saying, in order to serve this many mailboxes, I need this much capacity. But you don't think about an ultimate number. You're thinking about a slice. You're saying for 50,000 users, that's my provisioning unit, I want to have 5 email servers, 2 management servers, 3 app servers, 4 storage servers, whatever it is. And then you create a scale unit out of that, and that you scale. And you scale it out. Remember this cloud computing thing? Scale it out. And that's what the Hotmail guys did, and I'm sure lots of other cloud services did that already and do this, where you effectively are trying to push what is it that I need to do in order to serve a given capacity. The reason why I'm telling you this is while Azure and AWS and other environments are very, very flexible and fast provisioning resources, you might still want to say, in order to have a certain set of capacity, I need to have a unit set in order to serve it. You can still scale within the unit, meaning if you have a lot of web requests, your web role might be bigger in terms of number, and your worker roles might be less busy because there's not a lot of processing going on. So you can flex in there, but you don't want to ask Azure for one VM at a time. It's much easier to allocate 5 than just one, and then plus one, plus one, plus one. It takes longer than to allocate 5. And the prices, yes, you will be charged maybe a little bit more than you want to, but it's much more efficient for you, and it certainly I know that Mark will appreciate it because he can provision you faster than one at a time. So always think about what are the units that you want to scale, and don't think about the ultimate scalability in terms of I'm going to use a million services. Just use a fixed number of whatever it is you want to serve and plan and monitor. The key thing here is you need to monitor where am I with my capacity. Messaging is fairly easy because you're just saying, hey, it's 50,000 users. If I'm at 40,000, I'm going to add the next one. But it's certainly something that works for any scenario that I've so far seen. And scale unit-based designs are also very green because, again, everybody's very optimistic. When I deploy this SharePoint environment, I will have 100,000 users collaborating. When you really look under the covers, mostly they never get to this number. And even if they do, it takes 2 or 3 years to get there because users need to change and stuff like that. So you can save a lot of money by having a little capacity and growing the capacity over time in order to match demand. This is what ops people see when they look at applications. They see fog. And Microsoft products are equally bad as lots of custom applications I've seen. So let me tell you a little story, how ops people have to deal with us, the application people. So there is a very famous error message from a Microsoft product that says, operation succeeded, could not write, and there's a hex code behind it. And you're like, what? So what happens is, this is the workflow of the operator. They go into Google, because Google has done a better job on hex code searching than Bing has, even if they're Bing friendly. And they go into Google and they find social forum. That social forum says, I've seen this hex code before and I've done these 5 things. And people have tried it and sometimes it works. So you effectively get a myth to a legend, that kind of thing. You know the beginning of the Lord of the Ring, where all of a sudden this hex code is being resolved this way. Because that's what the operators do. They have no choice but to look at these kind of things because they don't know the code. And what really happened is the C drive was full. So this component was trying to write into the log file, which happened to be on the C drive, and the C drive was full, and so he couldn't. Wouldn't it be nice if the damn thing would have just said the C drive is full? Instead of hex code operation succeeded and that kind of nonsense. That's effectively what we application people do to these ops people. We don't tell them what's going on, and then we are smart because we use object orientation, right? So what we do is we pass the code to the next layer up. I don't know what to do. You deal with it. The next layer up says, I don't know what to do. And it goes all the way in the call stack to the back of the top of the tree And that thing, of course, has no clue what to do, and so either they fail, if they're nice, or they just write it into a log file and keep going, if they can. So, my guidance or plea to you guys, if you're application developers, start really thinking about instrumentation as a weapon you want to use. App Insights, New Relic, and other tools are out there to help you with that kind of instrumentation, runtime instrumentation, code instrumentation, and stuff like that. And if you write an error message, do so where the error occurs and use human language, not 0x100. What turns out, I'm not going to name the product team because it's a bit embarrassing, but they actually had a dynamic database where they were actually generating the error message dynamically out of the database internally, and they were all super smart because they knew exactly what that meant. They just didn't tell the operator, which wasn't really helpful. So if you see your operator looking at you like this, you know that you didn't instrument your code and you didn't help him or her be successful in their job. The way we solve it by now, by the way, our developers have a pager. If the service is down, they will get called. So the ops people are a very tiny group, so they look at the live side and see what moves and shakes, it's okay. And if something is broken, they immediately divert to the developer team, and the developer team gets called. Weird, instrumentation is now in, we have very, very defensive coding because the developer doesn't want to get up at 2 a.m. in the night to fix some stuff. So if you don't want to do instrumentation, then as the ops people, I suggest send pagers to the developers. It works. I can tell you from our experience, it does work. It's a very healthy attitude. So these are some of the patterns that we shipped last tech ed. In Tech Ed North America, we shipped cloud patterns, about 25. Here are some of them. So here's a health endpoint monitoring pattern. So you have an agent that effectively checks what's going on. And all of these patterns are written down at MSDN, I think, is where they're hosted. We will see the entire stack soon. Not going to go through all of them. Risk resiliency and modeling and analysis. So that's an interesting one. Always remember this thing. For some reason, they didn't find that objective, the pattern guys. Remember this guy. So awesome tool. Man, wouldn't it be fun? Then you see little guy coming in. Kaboom. So again, accompanying the failure mode analysis, always understand what the risk of exploitation of this stuff is. And our friends here didn't think they were vulnerable because they were very big and there was this little tiny problem, so not an issue. So they were effectively not using risk resilience modeling, saying, okay, document the failure points, discover what the failure modes might be, discover authorize incorrectness limits, blah, blah, rate them, and act on them. And then make sure that you only look at the reliability things that you can exploit. Not everything is equally important. If you have the simple thing with a configuration file, and you have a backup in your code that says the default configuration is X, that might be okay. You don't need to go crazy and fail the service and stuff like that. This is a modeling tool we're using internally to effectively help our teams do the modeling around what are the possible failures, who could exploit them, what is the probability that they will fail. We have used it for the SharePoint team, the commerce team, and a bunch of others with very high success. So this is a component interaction diagram. Again, components or services are interchangeable from a risk perspective. Of course, not on a granularity perspective. Then here is the discovery incorrectness, auth limits, and components. So a lot of stuff here are effectively common causes we have seen all over the place how services fail. And the analysis after the failure pointed out that, oh, name resolution, configuration, authentication, protocol or version mismatch, and stuff like that, timeouts and blocking, so when you have throttling involved from the dependent component, the service is unavailable, or it's throttling, flooding, so you're pushing a lot of stuff. We have seen people when the service on the other side responded with an error, I've seen coders actually increase the repeat cycle. Instead of stepping back and saying, no, let's give this service some time to recover. No, let's go faster and beat them harder so that they can respond faster. I imagine if you don't respond, your wife is beating on you, or if your husband, if you're the wife. That wouldn't work either if you don't respond. I know that with my girlfriend it doesn't work. She always complains when I said, why are you not answering? So think of this as the human component of this kind of interaction. What are the effects? Could be simple, then you don't do anything. What is the portion of the system that's affected? So think about that. How can you isolate parts? If it's the configuration part, who cares? Or if it's a credit card service that you depend upon and the service is not there, is there a business fallback that says, I'm actually going to take the orders no matter what, and I'll deal with the credit card later? There's lots of ways you can deal with this kind of stuff. The other piece that's very important is detection. A lot of systems don't know when things are broken. And putting that into your code is something that is very important, or at least use systems like New Relic or Visual Studio App Insights to help you with that. What is the resolution, and then what's the likelihood? Not everything will happen, so you don't necessarily have to have a response to it in code. IBM had a great effort called the Red Books, if you're an IBM shop. At the very least, you should have a human procedure that says, if this error occurs, even though we have nothing in code, what is the resolution to the problem for your applications? Not going to go through that little eye chart, but these are real risk models that we built for internal services. The presentation will be made available, so you can read them at leisure, and so forth. Retry pattern, we talked about that already. Just make sure, don't increase the retries when the service is already crying for help. Okay, so just don't do that. Circuit breaker, that's another really useful thing to learn. Again, Netflix is implementing this at their scale, where if you understand cloud computing, we talked about this, failures will happen. That's a normal thing. Until you reach a certain threshold, until the pain becomes too high. Remember the James Bond movie when they were playing with these things and the electricity current came to head? That's kind of the idea. It's cool, cool. It's getting a little bit hotter. Okay, I can still hold on. And at some point in time, you have to let go and let the service fail. And that's effectively what the circuit breaker pattern talks about. So you build in your threshold for pain, and then you do something about it. Shut down the service, call for help, or cry mama, something like that. Throttling pattern, we talked about that already in terms of understand when somebody's pushing you too hard, how you defend yourself. If somebody asks too much from you and you can't put it out, then you need to effectively push back. A lot of technology, like web servers, have throttling built in. So you can effectively determine on a configuration side what IIS is going to let through to you and what not. And I'm sure the Indians have the same thing, our Apache friends. So lots of technology has throttling built in, but it's up to you to determine what that means. This is the eye chart of all the patterns that the patterns and practice team has put out in one poster. I didn't even bother trying to bring them to me with me, because last time we tried to have a physical copy available, somebody said we can't give them out. So this is available on the website. I'll have the URL in a second. And you can download them. It has a very nice explanation of what's going on and how to implement them. And there are also code libraries, either open source on GitHub, that implement some of this in various code environments. Again, you will get this. So these are the solution design patterns, aka.ms, cloud design patterns. I think there are 25 of those, which are the most common patterns we see in scale-out distributed applications, because that's what cloud computing applications are. And sorry, this is from TechEd North America. I apologize, a bug in the slides. There are no copies available, at least not that I know of. So complete the feedback, please. Give me some ideas, and Tom, my my handler. We just learned or remembered this is the last ticket. So you guys are part of a historical event because A, it's the last ticket. I'm done. I don't do another presentation. And so I think we should all celebrate, rejoice. No. Join us at Microsoft Ignite, which is the new event that will be the mother of all events, I hear. And so I think we're coming back next spring or something. We combine Exchange, SharePoint, TechEd, Build, everything into one. Let's see. I don't know where we're going to go, but it's going to be fun. So please provide feedback. Tom reads it. I care. I read it. Really interested if this was useful, and so forth. Evaluate the session. And if you have comments, questions, come up. Happy to answer anything. We can go deep, broad, whatever you like. I certainly am very pleased that you were interested, and thank you very much for being here and listening. Thanks.